Good evening, and welcome to this edition of the Malloy Program on the 28th. We only have 3 days left in this year. Hey, hold on just a minute. Let me turn the heat off. It is still colder than a well digger's ass here in the foothills of the North Georgia Mountains. You know, couple of things. It's always nice to have your suspicions confirmed. And I've had several suspicions of mine confirmed in the past few days. One of them is about the inherent cowardice of conservatives. I'll get to that in a second. But the other thing, about libertarians, I have I've always noticed that real full-blown libertarians like Neil Bortz, radio talk show host, or Rand Paul, soon to be, what's he going to be, congressman? Senator? Senator? Is he senator? No. Is he? His old man, Ron Paul, Sarah Palin, these so-called libertarians, self-identified acolytes of Ayn Rand, I've always had a suspicion that they were childish, babyfied thumbsuckers. They can't complete projects. They can't do anything because they're like overgrown children. Until I told Bortz to stay out of my life forever. You know, I had like a 15-year relationship with him. Several of those years are when we both worked at WSB in Atlanta. And after going out to his house a couple of times and spending a little time with him, I realized that he was a spoiled brat, just a thumb-sucking whiner. Now, as is true of so many people who have that kind of problem, they label everyone else that way. Everyone else is a thumb-sucking whiner. But libertarians are babies. They're self-referential always. They're selfish always. They don't cooperate with anyone. They like to claim that they are self-made, so on and so forth. Now, libertarian political points of view, a lot of people say, yeah, well, that may be true, but I agree with Rand Paul, Ron Paul, a lot of times, like our foreign military operations. Ron Paul is against them. Okay, but that's not a libertarian point of view. That's a political point of view. That is strictly a political point of view. The idea that drugs should be legal, that's a moral point of view. The reason drugs are illegal is because we've had moralistic halfwits trying to tell us that, you know, the Chinese and the Mexicans and the Africans were African Americans were going to destroy our precious white society with their cocaine and their opium and their marijuana. So that's a racist political issue. Sex between consenting adults of any sort, between consenting adults. That's not a libertarian position. That's just a position of common sense and human rights. The right as a human being to at least your own sovereignty where it concerns what you do with your body sexually. As long as it's just you or you and one or more consenting adults. I mean, come on. That's not a libertarian position. They have adopted it. And I could go right down the list. All these positions that are allegedly libertarian positions is nonsense. These are points of view or political points of view that libertarians have tried to co-opt, tried to steal in order to justify their babyish, thumb-sucking, whiny kind of political philosophy, libertarianism. Christopher Beam, let me share you a couple sentences with you. Christopher Beam, writing New York Magazine, wrote the following, quote, "It's no coincidence that most libertarians discovered the philosophy as teenagers." That's very true, isn't it? At best, Beam writes, libertarianism means pursuing your own self-interest as long as you don't hurt anyone else. At worst, as in Ayn Rand's teachings, libertarianism is an explicit celebration of narcissism. Man's first duty is to himself, says young architect Howard Roark in his climactic speech in the Fountainhead. His moral obligation is to do what he wishes. Roark utters these words after dynamiting his own project, since his vision for the structure had been altered without his permission. The message? Never compromise. If you don't get your way, blow things up.
Where's my mommy's tit? I'm hungry.
And there's the problem. If everyone refused to compromise his vision, there'd be no cooperation. There would be no collective responsibility. The result wouldn't be a city on a hill. It would be a port town in Somalia. In a world of scarce resources, everyone pursuing his or her own self-interest would yield not Atlas Shrugged, but Lord of the Flies. And even if you did somehow achieve libertopia, you'd be surrounded by a-holes. You know what I'm saying? Well, when I saw that, Doc sent that to me. It was in New York Magazine. I thought, you know, that is perfectly, utterly, it's one of those crystalline truths. It's a non-reductive truth. You can't go. You can't parse that. It is so true. Libertarians are whiny-ass, thumb-sucking, anal retentive, developmentally stalled crybabies. Look at Sarah Palin.
Oh, I'm the governor? Oh, I don't want to be governor anymore. Goodbye. I don't want to be governor. I don't want this responsibility. I want to go play.
Okay, go play. But that's an identifying aspect of libertarianism. The inability to shoulder real responsibility, because responsibility means being able to respond. Response able. Able to respond to what? Your own nasty little selfish self-interest, or able to respond to your group, your clan, your society, individuals, other groups? Worked with. That's why you never, ever, under any circumstances, find any conservative or libertarian working towards something like world peace or social safety net or free medical care for everybody. Or you never find that. Never, ever, ever, ever. You know, this idea, this little catchphrase that was so popular. I pulled myself up by my own bootstraps. No, you didn't. not unless you moved to the wilderness someplace. Never saw another human being until you were 75. And in that process, no sisters, no brothers, no parents, no core group of family whatsoever. But somehow you built a automobile or opened up a refrigerator manufacturing plant where nobody worked, of course, because you've done this all on your own. You get the point. Libertarians are thumb-sucking, hair-twisting, bedwetting, whiny-ass crybabies. Every single one of them. The baby that was missing was found in a ditch today. And there's bombs flying, people dying.
Bye. hang back. And I love the way you walk, and I love the way you talk. When you walk that walk, and you talk that talk. You knocks me out off of my feet. Boom, 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 boom. Bang, bang.
21
bang,
past
bang.
The hour.
Boom, 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 boom.
By the way, this hour is sponsored by Nick Canost. And his message is the truth is out there. It just needs to be told. Thanks, Nick. Nick Canost. Now, the business about libertarians or conservatives or whatever you want to call them, they're all the same ilk to me. The idea that they're nothing but thumb-sucking crybabies, I can't think of any logical rebuttal to that. There can be an emotional rebuttal, but that's what libertarians do.
No, I'm not!
But a logical rebuttal is impossible. And why? Well, empirical truth. I mean, if something is perfectly round, it's referred to as a sphere. If somebody says, no, that's a square. By the virtue of, you know, universal acceptance that a round three-dimensional object is a sphere, the person screaming, no, it's a square, would be sent to the basement where he or she could watch Rupert Murdoch's terrorism channel. Now, here's another one. This is a study at University College in the UK has found that conservatives' brains have larger amygdalas than the brains of liberals. Now, amygdalas, don't run to your Wikipedia or to your dictionary.com. That's the part of the brain responsible for fear and the other so-called primitive emotions, you know, fight or flight, fear, sex, I guess. No, not sex. Where does the sex come from? This is your... Yeah, is that the amygdala too?
Yeah, I mean, the primitive reptilian part of your brain is where most of your pleasure centers are located because they're essential for your survival. Things like sex, food, shelter.
Fear.
Fear.
Stupidity.
Well, fear is a little more complex in the hippocampus, but from what I understand, I don't understand it all. But I do know that the most primitive reptilian part of your brain has to do with all of the survival instincts, you know.
Well, thank you. Amygdalas are responsible. Am I on? Amygdalas are responsible for fear and other primitive emotions. Now, that is a physiological truth. At the same time, what the study found is that conservatives' brains were also found to have a smaller anterior cingulate. That's the part of the brain responsible for courage and optimism. Do you get this? Amygdalas in conservatives are larger. That's where the fear resides. And the anterior cingulate in conservatives were smaller. That's a part of the brain responsible for courage and optimism. Now, this is the first medical or physiological explanation of why conservatives tend to be more receptive to threats of terrorism, for example, than liberals. Ever notice that? And it may help explain why conservatives like to plan based on the worst-case scenario, like, quick, let's dig a bomb shelter, buy gold, get this dehydrated flake stuff so that when the end comes, you can add water and, Liberals tend toward rosier outlooks. A neurologist, Garant Reese, who carried out the study, said, quote, it is very significant, these findings, because it does suggest there is something about political attitudes that are either encoded in our brain structure through our experience or that our brain structure in some way determines the results in our political attitudes. So we're getting down what this guy is saying more or less is a chicken egg thing. Which comes first, the brain's propensity in conservatives to be terrified of its own shadow, so to speak, and or does a conservative, by his or her attitudes, force a reduction in the part of the brain that contains or generates courage, and an enlargement in the part of the brain that contains fear and loathing? I would say it'd probably be the former. I can't see political attitudes influencing the size of brain parts, right? Anyway, this neurologist heads up the University College of London's Institute of Cognitive Neuroscience. And originally, the way the study came about, he was asked half-jokingly to study the differences between liberal and conservative brains for an episode of the BBC Today show that was hosted by actor Colin Firth. But after studying 9 UCL students and 2 British parliamentarians, the neurologist was shocked to discover a clear correlation between the size of certain brain parts and political views. Well, I'll be damned. What's that funny noise? What's that on the floor? Waves of fear pulsing with death. I curse at my tremors. I jump at my own step. I cringe at my terror. I hate my own self. I know where I must be. I must be in hell.
It's time for your humble and obedient servant, Mike Malloy.
At MikeMalloy.com in Kathy's diary, she pretty much explained. What was the word? Nementopen? Open your mic and tell us.
Nementomi. I mean, I don't speak Nahuatl.
Is that what that is, Nuala?
Yeah. Nemen? So, I mean, I can only guess. I think that would be the correct Aztecian pronunciation.
That's where we are. We're in the Nementomi, the 5 or 6 days towards the end of the calendar year. It doesn't make any difference what calendar you use. We're in the dead zone. We are in. Have you noticed on the news the past 3 or 4 nights? I realize there's been a lot of snowfall, but Jesus God. I mean, that's all. ABC, which I watched, and NBC, the first 5 stories. That's called the A Block. We're all about snow. And about a canceled NFL football game? Jesus Christ. Well, I wonder what the Chinese are talking about on their newscasts, right? This hour, by the way, is sponsored by Nick Canost, who writes, "The truth is out there. It just needs to be told." Thanks, Nick. The study about from the University College of London, that conservative brains have larger amygdalas than the brains of liberals. Amygdalas are responsible for fear. Conservatives' brains were also found to have a smaller anterior cingulate, the part of the brain responsible for courage. Huh? How long have I been talking about this? A couple of years. I knew it. Anyway, the guy who did the study said he was shocked to discover that correlation between the size of certain brain parts and one's political views. And he does caution that because the study was carried out only on adults, there's no way to tell what came first, the brain differences or the political opinions. And again, I will hold with the Occam's razor. The simplest explanation is usually the right one, and that is people who are born a certain way think a certain way. I mean, we're finding out more and more and more and more and more about genetic imprint and our DNA and all that stuff that we thought was our pulling ourselves up with our bootstraps and individualism and this and that and the other thing really has to do with genetic imprinting and has not a damn thing to do with, well, I think I'll go and be a millionaire. The study, another study published in October, researchers at Harvard and UC San Diego found that a variant of the DRD4 gene predisposes people to being liberal, but only if they had active social lives as adolescents. You know that to be true, too. What did John Boner do when he was a kid? Swept the floor of his dad's bar. According to him, that's all he ever did. Still does, more than likely. What did Haley Barbour do? Run around in a white sheet. Still does, probably. The so-called liberal gene, the DRD4, has also been linked to a desire to try new things. And other, according to the study, quote, personality traits related to political liberalism, end quote. So now what do? We normal people, we liberals, we progressives, what do now? If it is a matter of genetics and physiology and not a matter of having read Ayn Rand at the wrong time in one's development, what if it is a matter of chemistry, brain chemistry, or physiological reality? What then? Round them up and put them in a quiet place where they can no longer do destruction to the rest of the human race. That would be one solution. Hey, I got something here for you. This is from, if you think you know the answer to this, send me an email. We're only going to do this for about 10 minutes. I'm going to give you some, and Tim in L.A., don't, because you're the one that sent this to me. But I'm going to give you some specifics that have been written into the constitution of a country. And I want you to try to tell me what country it is. I'm going to be skipping around here. Article 22. Work is a right for all people in this country in a way that guarantees a dignified life for them. The law shall regulate the relationship between employees and employers on economic bases and while observing the rules of social justice. The state shall guarantee the right to form and join unions and professional associations, and this shall be regulated by law. Article 26. The state shall guarantee the encouragement of investment in the various sectors, and this shall be regulated by law. Various sectors like the arts. Article 27. Public assets, public parks, national parks, are sacrosanct, and their protection is the duty of each citizen. What? You mean I can't get the logging rights? I can't get mineral rights in Yellowstone? The provisions related to the preservation of state properties, their management, the conditions for their disposal, and the limits for these assets not to be relinquished shall be regulated by law. Article 28. Low-income earners shall be exempted from taxes in a way that guarantees the preservation of the minimum income required for living. This shall be regulated by law. Anybody? Article 29. The state shall guarantee the protection of motherhood, childhood, and old age, shall care for children and youth, and shall provide them with the appropriate conditions to develop their talents and abilities. Children have the right to upbringing, care, and education from their parents. Parents have the right to respect and care from their children, especially in times of need, disability, and old age. Economic exploitation of children in all of its forms shall be prohibited, and the state shall take the necessary measures for their protection. All forms of violence and abuse in the family, the school, and society shall be prohibited. Ooh. Who wrote this? Honest John the Commie? Article 30. The state shall guarantee to the individual and the family, especially children and women, social and health security, the basic requirements for living a free and decent life, and shall secure for them suitable income and appropriate housing. Also in Article 30, the state shall guarantee social and health security to the citizens in cases of old age, sickness, employment disability, homelessness, orphanhood, or unemployment, and shall work to protect them from ignorance, fear, and poverty, and shall provide them housing and special programs of care and rehabilitation, and this shall be regulated by law. Oh my, look at all the people are writing in the Soviet Union. No. Article 31. Every citizen has the right to health care. The state shall maintain public health and provide the means of prevention and treatment by building different types of hospitals and health institutions. Individuals and entities have the right to build hospitals, clinics, or private health care centers under the supervision of the state, and this shall be regulated by law. Article 32, the state shall care for the handicapped and those with special needs and shall ensure their rehabilitation in order to reintegrate them into society, and this shall be regulated by law. Article 33, every individual has the right to live in safe environmental conditions. The state shall undertake the protection and preservation of the environment and its biological diversity. Article 34, education is a fundamental factor for the progress of society and is a right guaranteed by the state. Primary education is mandatory, and the state guarantees that it shall combat illiteracy. Free education in all its stages is a right for all citizens. Wow. Article 35. The state shall promote cultural activities and institutions in a manner that befits the civilizational and cultural history of the state, and it shall seek to support blah, 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 blah. That, if I give you that phrase, it'll give it away. All right, I've got Article 37 and a little bit of Article 40 when we come back. I'm continuing to take your guesses as to what country this is. Nicaragua? No. Here's somebody has it right. Susan. Susan has it right. Cuba? No. Oh, who's this? There's another one has it right. Ilofan? Ilofan? We'll be right back. Sweet the meek, sick of the taste.
Hey, truth seekers, gather round the campfire. It's more Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour. All right, a lot of you are getting it now, but you're still in the minority. Whose constitution I'm quoting from? Just a couple more. Article 35, the state shall promote cultural... I already did that one. Article 37, no person may be kept in custody or investigated except according to a judicial decision. Judicial decision. All forms of psychological and physical torture and inhumane treatment are prohibited. Any confession made under force, threat, or torture shall not be relied on, and the victim shall have the right to seek compensation for material and moral damages incurred in accordance with the law. The state shall guarantee protection of the individual from intellectual, political, and religious coercion. Article 40. The freedom of communication and correspondence, postal, telegraphic, electronic, and telephonic shall be guaranteed and may not be monitored, wiretapped, or disclosed except for legal and security necessity by a judicial decision. That's enough. Huh? Kathy is, open your mic and what? Oh, who is it? Who? Yes. This is the Constitution that was written by the Bush crime family for Iraq. For Iraq. A right to a living wage. Dr. Martin Luther King was talking about that 40 years ago. 43 years ago, right before they murdered him. The right to a job. The right to public health care. Public health with an option. If somebody wants to set up a private clinic, go ahead. But the state shall provide income, health care, a broadening of cultural opportunities, music, art, dance, opera, theater. Public parks, public assets are sacrosanct. That would be, in this country, the infrastructure. They have to be taken care of. They must be taken care of. And the state shall make sure that they are taken care of. Oh, my God. Low-income earners exempted from taxes in a way that guarantees the preservation of the minimum income required for living. Living! And we have a goddamn debate about whether or not to give people unemployment compensation after 26 stinking weeks! Oops. Don't scream. Free education, all the way to the top, as much of it as you want. The state shall guarantee social and health security to Iraqis in cases of old age, sickness, employment disability, homelessness, orphanhood, or unemployment, and shall work to protect them from ignorance, fear, and poverty, and shall provide them housing and special programs of care and rehabilitation, and this shall be regulated by law. And you wonder why some of us scream and rant and froth and rave about these half-witted morons in right-wing radio and television who continue to tell you that this kind of stuff is communistic? How this was ever written by members of the Bush crime family is beyond me. Obviously, it was not written by them. It was written by someone else. And they put their imprimatur, is that the way you pronounce that word, onto this document. Son of a bitch is all I can say. How many American soldiers died for that Constitution? 5,000? 6,000? Astonishing. Just astonishing. When do you think the American people will say, hey, just a damn minute. My son, my daughter went over there and died so the Iraqi people can have that, at least in written form. Who knows? The Soviets had a wonderful constitution too, didn't they? For that matter, so do we! But it's not this good. So for the 6,000, actually the 50,000 families who sent soldiers over to that country and who came home, the soldiers came home in a box or a bag or an arm missing or two arms and a leg, or half a brain or, vital organs from the waist down or, that's what you died for. That's what you died for. That's what your son or daughter was grievously wounded for, so that the Iraqis can have something that corporate America would smash your face to the ground if you tried to get in this country. How does it feel, Mr. and Ms. America, to face that horrible truth? We'll be back after the break.
Jim Cook.
Seven past the hour, and this hour is sponsored by Nick Canost. His message this hour, thank you for the truth, just not very many people willing to express it. Thank you, Nick. A couple of emails here from Andre, who's in New York. Subject line, crybaby Republicans in the blizzard in New York City. He writes, wow, so with this crazy blizzard we had, and with the absence of reliable street cleaning services to the general population, due no doubt to tax cuts, budget cuts that provide these services, guess who is crowing the loudest? Those teabaggers slash Republicans from enclaves like Staten Island and Long Island, whose streets and their comfy cookie-cutter communities, I love alliteration, remained unplowed, and whose commuter rail service had experienced closures and delays. I think they were saying something about, our taxes pay for these things, and they knew about this storm weeks ago, and they didn't prepare for it. Mm-hmm. But didn't you guys say you didn't want to pay any taxes? Guess what? Less taxes equal less services. Yeah, Andre, that's a truth that right-wingers just can't get through their calcified skulls, even past the amygdala. It is time for Prairie 2's missive for this evening. And it's rather brief. Aqueducts and bullet trains. Prairie 2 writes, in another move to consolidate their economic power, China is cutting rare earth exports by 10% and will impose a higher export tariff on raw materials. Uh-oh. And in order to end interference from the dominant power from the last century, That would be us. They are moving ahead with military hardware programs years ahead of outside estimates. According to Admiral Robert Willard, the top U.S. commander in the Pacific, the Dongfeng 21D missile is now operational. This land-based missile system is designed to track and target aircraft carrier groups with the help of satellites, unmanned aerial vehicles, and over-the-horizon radar. Aircraft carriers and their accompanying ships are completely defenseless against this type of hypersonic attack. Oh, my. The missile itself is not a huge leap forward, but it is the supercomputers that direct them that make them so deadly. It's no coincidence that China now has the most powerful computers in the world. This kind of system is able to put into input high volumes of data from multiple sources, making any attempt to silence the system fruitless. To further illustrate aggressors at this level of computing power, to further frustrate aggressors, this level of computing power renders stealth aircraft obsolete, as it is not necessary to paint the target with radar, but simply observe the hole in background EM radiation that the stealth technology creates. Oh, my. Someone invents the pistol, someone else invents the rifle. Ah! To project their power still further into the world, China is now building its own aircraft carriers to add to a mushrooming fleet of ships and submarines. This allows China to provide military protection to its trading partners, like perhaps Venezuela and Iran, who have been getting nominal protection from Russia. Rather than just strip mining the third world, China has been building infrastructure and improving the economies of their trading partners like no empire since the Romans. The Romans built aqueducts and roads in conquered lands. China is building steel mills and high-speed rail lines in countries like Brazil. As America fades away under the weight of Reaganomics, the world has a new dominant force, and it's time to learn to adapt. Practice saying this, Wo buhui shub zan zhuen, which means, I can't speak Chinese. Prairie2.com. Isn't that the truth? The Chinese, I mean, we go into countries and burn, kill, destroy, bomb, assassinate, infiltrate, overthrow, devalue. In other words, when American-style capitalism sees something that it wants, for the past 130 years, it just goes and takes it. 10,000 people die? Eh. 1 million? Eh. 2 million? Eh. 3 million? Eh. The Chinese, look at countries where there are natural resources to be exploited. The Chinese form of capitalism, which is state capitalism, as opposed to corporate capitalism, the state capitalism, I guess I can make that distinction. I'm just making this up as I go along. I'm sure someone will correct everything I've said tonight, as is usually the case. But the Chinese style of capitalism says, okay, we'll go ahead and exploit the natural resources of Brazil. But instead of making them feel battered and bloodied, literally and psychologically, we will go there and we will build bridges and roads and dams and power plants. We will improve the quality of life for the people in whose countries we want to establish our hegemony. And as Prairie 2 points out, this has not been done since Rome. Oh my. Wo buhui shuo zhuangwen. Zhuang Gwen. Sounds like John Glenn, doesn't it? Wo buhui shuo Zhuang Gwen. I can't speak Chinese. Hey, how about that new technology, huh? The stealth aircraft. Remember when the United States was talking about, oh, we got stealth aircraft. It doesn't even show up on radar. We can go bomb and strafe and kill and butcher and murder and do anything we want now. Aha! How about this? And the Chinese eventually say, very interesting. That's really cool. However, we now have computer systems that finds the hole where your aircraft is, because everything else is emitting some sort of a radiation, except your stealth aircraft. Bingo! We found you! Click. Boom! Oh my. Over the horizon targeting. I mean, from a land-based, well, sure, ICBMs do that, but we are talking about going after moving aircraft carriers. I wonder whose fleet the Chinese are most concerned about. Let's see. Would it be the German fleet? No. The Japanese fleet? No. The Cuban fleet? No. The Brits? No. Whose fleet of warships would most concern the Chinese at this point in their conquering of the entire globe? Ours! You're right! We'll be back after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds are getting so much reason.
With the truth. It's more Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. This hour is sponsored by Nick Canost, whose message is thanks for the truth, just not very many people willing to express it. Thanks, Nick. From Michael in Roswell, New Mexico, with regard to the Iraqi Constitution, what needs to be said is that constitutions are meaningless unless they're scrupulously observed. Torture in Iraqi prisons is commonplace. Sectarian violence is commonplace and is very nearly institutionalized in the Iraqi Interior Ministry, and infrastructure in Iraq is still virtually non-existent. That constitution and rules implemented by the CPA, Provisional Authority, what's the C stand for? Our people when we went in there. Also enabled foreign countries, namely us, to expatriate 100% of profits, to buy state businesses for pennies on the dollar, set a flat tax of 15%, and CPA orders still in place make it unlawful for Iraqi farmers to have seed, thus opening agriculture to Western GMO seed producers like Monsanto. Quite apart from the Constitution, as approved by the Iraqi General Assembly, the intent was to turn the country into a laissez-faire capitalist playground. All in all, constitution or no, the only winners have been U.S. contractors and mercenaries. true. And I made kind of a very lukewarm attempt to point that out by saying, well, you know, the Soviet, the constitution of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics was similarly hypocritical and farcical. But the fact that such a document could be written points out either or both that the people who wrote it are cynical beyond belief, given the reality in Iraq, as Michael points out. The cynicism is staggering. It's just off the chart cynicism. A. B. A direct smash in the face to Americans, given the fact that the requirements of that Constitution are not being met. Absolutely not. Do you want to go live in Iraq? Do you want to go open a frozen yogurt stand or a little business in Iraq? Would you like to do that? Since the Constitution is so pro-life. So a double smash in the face from the people who wrote that Constitution, a deliberate slap to the Americans, and the height of cynicism to the rest of the world who understands, as Michael pointed out, the only winners in our invasion, destruction, and occupation of Iraq, the only winners have been corporations, capitalism, of the most vile kind, the same sort that is propping up Hamid Karzai. It's a fun place we live, isn't it? And George in Oregon points out, regarding that Chinese computer technology, you know where all that whiz-bang computer technology came from? Look where your laptop and all of your high-tech electronics were made. Designed in the U.S., made in China. Think maybe there was a little technology transfer there? We gave them the rope, and they're going to hang us with it. Meanwhile, in Middle Europe, this just came to my attention at about 3 hours ago, 2.5 hours ago. The right-wing government in Hungary has passed a law now demanding that news sources be, quote, fair and balanced, end quote. Now, not the way you and I think of the term fair and balanced, but more along the lines of how the Murdoch terrorist empire considers fair and balanced. As Raw Story reports it, as the world's attention focuses on WikiLeaks and the debate has spawned about the extent of press freedom in the information age, Hungary's recently elected right-wing government has introduced a law demanding, under threat of fines and even shutdown, that news sources be fair and balanced, to borrow a phrase from a U.S. network. The move has critics fearing that it could lead to a silencing of critical media outlets. Under the new law on media and the freedom of press, national TV channels whose news coverage is found to be unbalanced or offensive to human dignity or common morals, that's the way it's written, could be fined the equivalent of almost $1 million, according to reports the New York Times, while daily newspaper and internet news sites could face fines of $120,000, weeklies and magazines could see fines of almost $50,000. More on this when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Jesus, in the song you wrote, the words are sticking in my throat. Peace on earth. Hear it every Christmas time. With hope and history won't rhyme. So what's it worth? This peace on earth. Peace on earth.
your news unfiltered, only with Mike Malloy.
Soul. 25 before the hour. So the right-wing government in Hungary has decided to impose press censorship, Hungarian style, I guess. Everything has to be... has to be fair and balanced. Are they serious with that? Human rights groups say the law is vague on what constitutes an offense. And the law will be administered by an agency controlled by the prime minister's allies, which, of course, is a perfect recipe for political oppression. According to Raw Story, the law has raised concerns among Hungary's European Union partner countries, particularly given that the country will assume the EU's rotating presidency on January 1st. Germany in particular has questioned whether Hungary can now be considered a legitimate representative of European values. Hoo-ah. The law has also raised concerns among human rights groups. Amnesty International described the law as unprecedented in the European Union and suggested that the agency created to determine whether news outlets are in compliance is stacked with political allies of the prime minister and would essentially have the freedom to punish news outlets as it sees fit. goes on to say this controversy hasn't ruffled Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban, whose right-of-center coalition government holds a two-thirds supermajority in parliament, which gives Orban the power to change the constitution if he wants to. As quoted in the New York Times, Orban said in a TV interview, quote, "We are not even thinking in our wildest dreams about making amendments to the law. I am not inclined to react with wobbly knees to debates in parliament or Western reactions. There is not a single passage in the law that does not correspond to the media law in EU countries," end quote. Gyorgy Conrad, a prominent Hungarian writer and communist-era dissident, said the law reminds him, quote, "very much of 1933, when the Nazi Party came to power with an electoral majority under seemingly democratic conditions." Conrad added, "even if Hungary is a small country in comparison with Germany, and even though a reign of terror is unlikely, there is no calling this country a democracy anymore." Oh, my. Things are just rattling the hell out of me. How about you in this week, this dead week, between the final co-opted pagan celebration and the beginning of a agreed-upon beginning of a new year? Well, not to the Chinese, not to the Japanese, not to the Israelis, not to the most Muslims. It just makes it easier to keep track of things if we refer to this as the closing days of 2010, right? This hour is sponsored by Nick Canost, who writes, "Thank you for the truth. Just not very many people willing to express it." Indeed. Okay, let's do that. Let's do some phone calls here. Gene is in Detroit. Oh, hi, Gene. Gene called in I don't know, several weeks back about the hell you were going through. Have things changed?
No.
No?
No.
What's going on now, Gene?
I'm just trying to get my act together, get out of the house what I want to get out of before I let them have it.
Before you let the bank have it?
Yeah. Before I let the banks have it.
Banks, plural.
But I think I have, the lawyer told me that before they can to me, they have to, I have to go in court. and that'll be very shortly. He's after the either the 4th or the 7th of January.
Mm-hmm. And what happened?
Like within, they have days, I believe, after the date on my deed. I had to go get a copy of it to know the date that they sold it or
what?
And
go ahead.
Anyway, so he told me that if I was still here after the date, that they'd have a week to get me into court, and that the judge could give me like 30 days, and then I'd have out, which is fine.
What have these banks that want to throw you on the street, have they proven in court that they really have the note on your house? That seems to be one of the issues that a lot of attorneys are raising. So many mortgages were sliced and diced and turned into phony investment packages that nobody knows who really owns these. A lot of houses being repossessed, these foreclosures. And some attorneys are demanding to see from the bank or the banks or the lending institutions that are trying to seize a house, are demanding to see papers that prove that that lending institution actually owns it. Have you pursued that line, Gene?
No, because I've been unemployed for over 3 years, and I'm a 99er, so I have no money coming in.
So you can't get a lawyer?
I have a lawyer. He's part of our organization.
You do have a lawyer. Have you talked to him about finding out if this lending institution that's taking you to court, if they actually own your property? If they don't, and you don't have the money to make payments, well, they can't throw you out any more than I could throw you out. And until somebody proves...
I know what you're getting at, Mike, but they're doing a lot of... These banks are doing a lot of stuff, especially here in the city of Detroit.
Well, sure they are.
All money from supposed to go to education. Like 80% of the funding Detroit gives for the education goes directly to the bank. They have us over a barrel. And I'm getting too old, quite frankly. I'm too old to take care of this house now. I just turned 60 a couple months ago. Mm-hmm. And, I'm tired of it.
Yeah, where are you going?
They want it.
Where
they can have it back.
But where would you go, Gene?
Well, I said I'm supposed to go down with my cousin, but my only fear that, and it wouldn't matter where I go because of this fear, I just, because of my age, I want to become a burden to my younger cousins. But no matter where I go, that's what I'm going to have to deal with. I was already discriminated against in my 40s when I only looked to be in my 30s. I was job discriminated against.
It's almost impossible when a person hits their 60s, if they are let go, outsourced, fired, the company closes, whatever, it's almost impossible to find a job.
Yeah, I figure that, so mm-hmm. I'll have to do what I do. Whatever that may be. But I will, as long as I can, fight these bastards.
I hope you do. And as far as not having the money to continue to make payments, well, no.
I haven't paid my mortgage payment for... I got an extension 3 years ago, I think it was. And it went back to paying it again. I got it caught up. And I paid it for a year. And then... I just quit paying it. would be 2 or 3 years ago in May. I just plain quit paying it.
Mm-hmm.
And because I knew that I was already broke.
Right.
So I had to save up what little money that I could to get out of here. So that's what I've done. But with nothing coming down, I mean, we're $400 gas bills here.
Hold on a second, Gene. Let me put you on hold. We'll come right back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Free zone.
It's 10 before the hour, and this hour is brought to you by Nick Canost, who writes, "Thank you for the truth, just not very many people willing to express it." We're talking with Gene in Detroit, who called in several weeks back about some of the exceedingly difficult stuff she was going through. The point I was trying to make, Gene, here in Atlanta, we have, in the city proper, we have a very high foreclosure rate, bank failures, all sorts of craziness. Housing prices in Atlanta are falling faster than any place else in the country right now. But in Atlanta, And in Florida, which also has an incredibly high foreclosure rate, attorneys representing people who are in the situation that you're in, facing foreclosure, the attorneys figured out, wait a second, how can this person be foreclosed on if the institution doing the foreclosing doesn't really have control of the note? Are you sure, Gene, that the people trying to throw you out of your house are the people who made the loan to you?
Well, actually, they're not. When I refinanced in 2005, I think it was, before my first house payment after that, I got switched to another bank. And even before that first, I got switched to, my current bank. And they're just as evil as Bank of America.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the lawyers that we work with,
mm-hmm.
there's way so much more to this fraud that's being perpetrated on us. They profit more. The banks profit more by throwing you out.
Sure.
That's the reason that nationally, I can't remember the exact amount, but there's only been maybe under 2,000 homes financed across the country.
Mm-hmm.
By trying to help people.
Right. I know.
And the reason for that is because banks get more money when they throw you out.
Yeah, that whole...
They want to get involved in that.
Right, the whole long process of fees and penalties and interest. Yeah, it just keeps going and going. I've got to move on right now, Gene, but I want to ask you two things. First of all, will you please call back in before, if it happens, you have to vacate that house before you leave, A. B, will you please ask whoever your lawyers are, however they're helping you out here, whatever the deal is, will you please ask them if they have explored the idea of challenging the people who are trying to throw you out as to whether or not they really have the right to throw you out?
Can I ask you a favor, Mike?
Sure.
I've been wanting to do this for years.
Go ahead.
But I couldn't get back into my account website to do it. I wanted to have you allow Attorney Vanessa Fluker to come on and talk to you about the stuff that we found.
Sure. Just tell her to send Kathy an email.
Because I can post. I think you see my Facebook page. I'm also on your Facebook page. And a week or two ago, I posted where one of our other members and Vanessa Fluker did testimony before the House Judiciary Committee and John Conyers, and where exposed what was going on. But I'll repost it so you can see it.
All right, do that, and I'll have I'll ask Kathy to check, and when you make that posting, maybe we can get your attorney on. All right.
Okay.
Thanks, Gene.
Thank you.
Stay in touch. I wish I could say something more substantial than stay in touch, but I don't know what the hell it would be. I really don't. Yeah, if that information is posted at the Malloy Show Facebook page, Kathy, let's invite this attorney on. You know, what Gene was just talking about kind of ties in with Bob Herbert's column in the Times today. And it was my thought, too. His opening line, I keep hearing from the data zealots that holiday sales were impressive and the outlook for the economy in 2011 is not bad. Maybe they've stumbled onto something in their windowless rooms. But in the rough and tumble of the real world where families have to feed themselves and pay their bills, there are an awful lot of Americans being left behind. There's some more of this I want to share with you because I think it does connect to what Gene is talking about. And Blue is in Buenos Aires. He's been holding on for 40 minutes. We'll get to him. You might want to tell the people holding on because Matt has been holding on for an hour. Let them know. I'll get to them when we come back. Okay? Thank you. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back. It is 7 past the hour. This is the Malloy Program, and this hour also sponsored by Nick Canost. His message this hour, thank you for the truth, just not very many people willing to express it. Nick winds up sponsoring all 3 hours. Thanks, Nick. regarding Gene, whose situation is stunningly unacceptable. It would be any place, but especially in the United States, especially in Detroit. Is not uncommon how many millions of people have been forced into this. And coupled with that news, I've been following reports in business sections in newspapers and some of the cable networks. This rah-rah report that, hey, everything's back to normal. Retail sales have rebounded. Beat the forecast. Woo-woo! Retail spending rose 5.5% in the 50 days before Christmas. Yee-haw! You know, I read that and I think, I mean, I can't do that. I can't hold the two opposing ideas. There are certain things in opposition that I can hold at the same time. Cognitive dissonance is not one of my strong suits. There are a few things that I can do that with, one or two. But for the most part, I can't do that. I see these reports about, hey, everything's good, man. Damn. And then I read other reports about how bad economically things are and how we are on a down slope that simply is not going to change. We really are not going to pull out of this the way a lot of people are hoping that we will. And in fact, this kind of weird optimism rather than an acceptance of the way things are and work with what we've got. This optimism, and I don't even call it this delusional sense that, oh no, we're going to get back to the way things were in the late 90s and into the early 2000s. Yes, we are. No, we aren't. The American century is over. It really is. It's probably not going to really register that it's over for another 5, 6, 8 years. But friends and neighbors, truth seekers, it's over. I mean, what does it take? What kind of a sledgehammer has to slam up against the heads of people in this country to make them understand that the 21st century belongs to China? There is no way to get around that. Give me anything that says that that's not the case. You know, the so-called American exceptionalism, which was phony to begin with, I think, but it's gone. It's over. That's it. We had our 100 years. Huh? So Bob Herbert comments on the fact that the data zealots say the holiday sales are impressive and everything's looking up. But he also writes, a continuing national survey of workers who lost their jobs during the Great Recession, conducted by Rutgers University, offers anything but a rosy view of the economic prospects. For ordinary Americans, it paints instead a portrait filled with gloom. More than 15 million Americans are officially classified as jobless. The professors at Rutgers have been following their representative sample of workers since the summer of 2009. The report on their latest survey just out this month is titled, quote, "The Shattered American Dream, : Unemployed workers lose ground, hope, and faith in their future," end quote. Over the 15 months that the surveys have been conducted, just one quarter of the workers have found full-time jobs, nearly all of them for less pay and with either fewer or no benefits. The report says, quote, "For those who remain unemployed, the cupboard has long been bare," end quote. As Herbert writes, these are not the folks being coldly and precisely monitored, classified and quantified as they made their way to the malls to kickstart the economy. These were among the many millions of Americans who spent the holidays hurting. As the report states, quote, the recession has been a cataclysm that will have an enduring effect. It is hard to overstate the dire shape of the unemployed, end quote. Nearly two-thirds of the unemployed workers who are surveyed have been out of work for a year or more. More than a third have been jobless for 2 years. With their savings exhausted, many have borrowed money from relatives or friends, sold possessions to make ends meet, and decided against medical examinations or treatments they previously would have considered essential. Older workers who are jobless are caught in a particularly precarious state of affairs. As the report put it, quote, we are witnessing the birth of a new class, the involuntarily retired. Many of those over age 50 believe they will not work again at a full-time real, quote, quote, job commensurate with their education and training. More than one quarter say they expect to retire earlier than they want, which has long-term consequences for themselves and society. Many will file for Social Security as soon as they are eligible, despite the fact that they would receive greater benefits if they were able to delay retiring for a few years, end quote. Something Herbert doesn't mention in this is how many people are applying for supplemental Social Security benefits based on disability. And the Republicans are going to try to end Social Security. They want to turn it over to capitalist America so that the bankers and the freaks and the greed, the sons of bitches, the people who are destroying America can have more billions to play with. Herbert writes, there's a fundamental disconnect between economic indicators pointing in a positive direction and the experience of millions of American families fighting desperately to fend off destitution. Some three out of every four Americans have been personally touched by the recession. Either they've lost a job or a relative or close friend has, and the outlook, despite the spin being put on the latest data, is not promising. No one is forecasting a substantial reduction in unemployment rates next year. And as Motoko Rich reported in the Times this month, temporary workers accounted for 80% of the 50,000 jobs added by private sector employers in November. Herbert says the fact that so many Americans are out of work or working jobs that don't pay well undermines the prospects for a robust recovery. Jobless people don't buy a lot of flat-screen TVs. What we are really seeing is an erosion of standards of living for an enormous portion of the population, including a substantial segment of the once solid middle class. Not only is this not being addressed, but the self-serving rightward lurch in Washington is all but guaranteed to make matters worse for working people. I don't know. How do you absorb and process that kind of stuff, information, and remain in a sense just remain unaffected by it? Not that the listeners of this program are unaffected by it, but, I mean, how do people deny this reality? Say, well, a lot of people went to the mall. Hey, look, 5.5% increase over last Christmas sales. Hey, listen, woohoo, we're okay. You know, that great engine of consumerism is running again. It may be only hitting on 6 cylinders instead of 8, but by God, it's running. Woohoo!
yourself with the truth. It's More Mike Malloy.
In the state of the world that we live in, where no one gives a damn about the future of children.
21 past the hour. All right, Blue. Sorry it took so long. Blue's in Buenos Aires tonight. Welcome to the program.
Hey. Hey, buonasera, Michael.
Buonasera, whatever.
Well, never mind. That's all right. We're in a place called La Boca, which is a suburb. Well, it's not a suburb. It's a district of Buenos Aires. It's mostly Italian here. And the funny thing is we're in a sushi place, and it's a Japanese family, but the girls all have Italian Christian names. It's pretty weird, but it's great.
Doesn't Boca mean mouth?
Yeah, that's right. And this whole district, I guess, was settled a long time ago by mostly Italian immigrants, and they speak a lot of Italian here.
Yeah.
And even when they speak Spanish, it's sort of like, you know, you sort of like feel that you're in Genoa someplace or Milan. But it's great. Anyway, obviously this is Scrooge McBlue, the filthy rich Australian capitalist yobbo calling.
Yeah, yeah. It's you all over.
Yeah. But, you know, I was telling Kath earlier, we just came, I don't know whether I mentioned this, we just came from a tango place and I fell down. I was doing all right for a bit. I thought it was Carlos Gardel reincarnated, and then I crashed into a table. And knocked over people's drinks and so on, and, you know, we had to sort of slink out. But
now, are you there because your pilot's job took you there, or why are you in Buenos Aires?
Well, I'm here courtesy, basically, of friends, yes, friends in the business. Obviously, this is not something we would have undertaken on our own. But I was telling Kath earlier, look, we spent the last 10 days, 2 weeks with families in Chile and now in Argentina,
right.
both of them lost relatives, and you know they were members of the desaparecidos, you know, the people
right.
who were
the disappeared
by
right.
by the CIA through Galtieri in Argentina and Pinochet in Chile.
Right.
And it made me think. This is the reason I called so soon, because I thought maybe I shouldn't call tonight after everything that's you know that's gone on, but I had to call because talking about what happened last week with the people calling in, and, you know, they were talking about, well, you know, we didn't go to Washington. We don't demonstrate. We sit at home and do stuff on the Internet.
Right.
And the grandmother of the family we're staying with now here, she went out during the regime, the generals, uh-huh. Galtieri and that bunch of bastards.
Right.
And these people were going out by the tens of thousands, women and children and old men, and they were going out demanding what was happening to their country and to their relatives and getting beaten up and tear gassed and the rest of it. And so that led to a conversation, and my wife said, look, if you people had had the Internet back then in those days during Pinochet and Galtieri, would you have stayed home and traded nasty messages about the regime on your email and figured that that was quite enough? And you know, they were stunned, and that led to a conversation about Lech Walesa, you know, telling the dock right. workers in Gdansk, you know, well, you know, stay home, blokes, don't come to the shipyard today. We'll just we'll stay home and trade nasty messages on the internet about Jaruzelski, and I'm sure that will terrify the bastards, you know.
Mm.
So, you know, and you could go on with Václav Havel in Czechoslovakia
right.
and the whole thing,
right?
But I think you understand the point I'm trying to make.
Of course. I do understand the point you're trying to make. And I think a couple of the people who responded were actually able, in a sense, to do as much or more by using social networks. I mean, you know, you can go back to... Let's go back to Tiananmen Square in, when was that, 89?
Right.
And, yeah, there were several hundred thousand Chinese people who gathered there with this idea, not of overthrowing anything, but just getting some freedoms granted to them. And they were letting the world know what was going on, if you'll remember, using fax machines. Doesn't that seem so quaint? And so last century, but they were using fax machines
Oh, Mike, I have to stop you a moment and ask, what's a fax machine?
Well,
it's
an odd little mechanical device, and it was mechanical. It wasn't electronic.
I have to protest that they did come out in Tiananmen Square.
They
came out in hundreds of thousands, and they came out night after night after night.
That's true. But
and more than one of these poor drongos got run over by tanks and so on.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And
my only point was that in order to let the larger population know what was going on, they used these means of letting not just other Chinese, but letting the world know. And I'm not defending anyone who is an armchair revolutionary. That's not how it works. And you know that.
But
I know
someday,
that.
I'm sorry. Excuse me a moment. I have to interject. Someday we've got to talk about what happened in Queensland a number of years ago. When we had a crooked regime in Queensland.
Oh,
I don't know whether you're familiar with it.
Is that when Rupert Murdoch's father was instrumental using his newspaper, I believe it was, to... hey, hold on a second. I got to do a commercial. We'll be right back.
Don't go to bed angry. Let Mike Malloy do it for you.
Yeah, sure. 25 before the hour. This hour is brought to you by Nick Canost. He's our sponsor for this hour. And for the previous two, he writes, thank you for the truth. Just not very many people willing to express it. What happened to Blue? Blue hung up? Lost the connection? Well, he was holding on for... long time, just like poor old Matt here in Minneapolis listening on KTNF. Been on for an hour and a half, right, Matt?
Yes, Mike, but that's okay. I was listening to your show.
Oh, okay. All right. Sorry.
No, it's okay. And what I'm going to say may pale in comparison to poor Gene there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so many nights I listen to your show, and I reach for the phone, and then I stop myself. I'll let somebody else call in. But tonight, listening to that Iraq Constitution thing, I couldn't help myself. I was thinking Sweden, Denmark, some of the northern European countries.
Right.
It's incredible. But it's this kaleidoscopic reality that we're living in now, that this Iraq Constitution represents. And you were correct in pointing out that, you know, it's like the Soviet Constitution, which probably sounds real nice. It is not enforced, and mm-hmm. you're not taken in by it completely.
Right.
But the fact that they wrote it and had the wherewithal to think of these things and yet crassly do the exact opposite.
Sure.
It's 1984.
The other part that is stunning to me is the fact that American military personnel were told that they were going to Iraq to bring democracy, to overthrow the dictator Saddam, and all the other stuff that that soldiers are told before they're sent into combat, so that they will go in with the objective of killing people and destroying things. It's pretty difficult, I would think, to do that, destroy things, blow things up, kill people, unless you're properly motivated. And properly motivated in so many instances means believing the lies that are told to you by your military commanders and the U.S. government as to why you're there to begin with. And again,
and Rush Limbaugh being piped in on Armed Forces Radio, by
right.
the way.
And I just go back to what two-time Congressional Medal of Honor winner, General Smedley Butler, said about war as a racket. I don't, you know, I'm not making this stuff up. I'm not just anti-military. I look at the people in the military who have figured it out, and Smedley Butler figured it out a century ago, why the Marines were being used in Central America and in the Far East. And, you know, he, of course he figured it out. So did Mark Twain. So did Jack London. So did a lot of people. But the average American just continued to bobblehead along with the idea that there was something glorious and wonderful and sweet and godly about our going to other countries, killing people, taking their resources, overthrowing their governments, destabilizing their currencies. I mean, it's just, I don't know. Truth, Matt, sometimes I just get so tired of talking about this. You know what I'm saying?
I know.
I just get so tired of it.
I know. And this is what, instead of prosecuting and saying, oops, you know, this was not right, you know, John Kerry is booed and Dick Cheney is cheered at VFW halls.
Astonishing.
We're living in an alternate universe, and there's no move to address it. I don't know.
I don't know either, because when you have people who are, By the definition of their policies, are mass killers, like Cheney.
Yeah.
And then you have people like Kerry, who, he became, I don't know what he was when he enlisted, but he became a reluctant warrior, and he came back and he testified during the Winter Soldier hearings way back in, what, the 70s?
Yeah.
Early 70s, about what was going on over there. And then you have the leading, I guess, one of the leading veterans organizations turning against Kerry and applauding a six-time draft dodger who has no problem committing other families' sons and daughters to murder and mayhem, but he himself is such a goddamn coward, Dick Cheney would no more step into a combat zone or anywhere near one, then he would fly.
Well, he would, except he had other priorities. That's
right,
what he said.
Right. He had other priorities. Then,
yeah, we all had other priorities. When
sure.
I cannot get over it.
I
Ted Nugent, same thing.
Yes, he's another one.
That coward. Quickly, for anyone who's interested, there's a book, These United States. Everyone, read the chapter on Florida. I've been online looking at it. And the last paragraph will kind of explain why we Americans accept these outrageous conditions. It's a country of hope. Mm-hmm. I wish I could find it before I'd read the paragraph. But, you know, I don't know. I won't burden you. But These United States, compilation of authors, each writing about their own state.
Right.
You may have read it.
No, I've not, but I've...
You've heard of it?
Yes.
Joe Leonard, I think, John Leonard. Online. Anyway, like I said, it all pales in comparison to what Gene and thousands of others are going through. But it's all part of it. This 1984-ish twisting of reality and the language.
Well, it was like what I read last night by Chris Hedges, that the two dystopian novels that more or less define what is happening now, 1984 and Brave New World. New World was the precursor, in a manner of speaking, to the plot line and the characters and so on and so forth. Was the precursor to what happened then in 1984. It made hideous, horrible sense to me that, and so much sense that we, Kathy and I, are considering reading, A Brave New World on the air, the way we read the entire novel, 1984. It took us about, I don't know what, Kathy, 3 or 4 months to read 1984. We allowed about 15 minutes every night.
I remember, and I've been meaning to ask you, are you ever going to do it again? Because
well,
I love that.
Yeah, if we do it, it's going to be Brave New World, because I think the way, what is happening right now is more in line with, well, we're drifting from, obviously, from the Brave New World model to the 1984 model. And the thing that really gets me is, you know, I don't want to be here. I don't want to be here in this time, in this place. You know, I just don't. I was brought up to believe in American exceptionalism. I always kind of looked at it with kind of a jaded eye. I mean, I didn't buy the whole thing completely because I knew the history of the labor movement in this country from an early age. I knew, that certain things went on levels way, way above my pay grade that dictated how I and my family were going to live or what we were going to have to deal with. There was always a little bit of suspicion, but I still believe I was brought up in that era. You know, the mid-20th century, that's my era. I was brought up to believe this stuff. And it wasn't that I was specifically individually brainwashed. I was brainwashed, like most Americans, from every single aspect, from entertainment, from information, from media, from the schools, from the preachers when I used to go to church, from everybody had the same story. And there was no way that you could step back from that unless you just forced yourself out of it and say, wait a minute, this is not what they're telling me it is. And it took the longest time for me to come to terms with that. And you know the truth, I still feel just the slightest echo of guilt for feeling that, for realizing I didn't and cannot buy the story. That to me, American exceptionalism is hogsnot. And I think once I realized that this country was founded on genocide and slavery, that was what tore it for me. It took me the longest time. I don't know why, but to connect and add 2 + 2 and to realize genocide and slavery, holy God. I mean, that's the glorious United States of America. And I don't care if other countries started the same way. All empires start that way. I understand that. The Roman Empire, the Greeks, the Assyrians, Genghis Khan. I mean, name me one that didn't start that. They all start that way.
Yeah,
but I'm a victim of my own cultural lies, and or I was for the longest time. So now, you know, I look at all this and I think, you know, I really don't want to be here. I wish I was somewhere else. I wish things were not the way they are in this, my country and my culture and my society. I wish it wasn't like this. Well, you know, somebody said to me one time, you know, wish in one hand and poop in the other and see which one fills up the quicker, right? Hey, Matt, thanks for checking in, man.
Okay.
I appreciate it. Take care. Take care. Before the hour. It's been a while since I mentioned some of our contributors to the program who really add quite a bit. Also, I want to mention one more time, thanks to Nick Canos, who is sponsoring this hour. Sponsored all 3 hours tonight. Way to go, Nick. He writes, thank you for the truth, just not very many people willing to express it. Nick Canost, who is our sponsor for this hour and the previous one and the one before that. Our military affairs correspondent is Sharon Gordy. And, yeah, our technical advisor is still around, Ben Birch. White Rose Society. Our economic affairs correspondent, of course, is Bruce Enberg, or as you know him so affectionately, Prairie numeral 2, Prairie 2. Education is Kay Petrini. And our two ethics advisors, Bob Alexander and Bridget Wolf. Kathy Bay is the executive producer and also engineers the program and somehow makes it happen most nights. Not. Oh, and by the way, program note, I think we're going to be off Thursday night and Friday night. And that will be our big vacation. What do? We took off Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. Oh, Christmas Day is Saturday. So we took off Christmas Eve, and we took off the previous Friday, and then we're taking off Thursday and Friday this week. 4 days spread over 3 weeks. I don't hear any bitching complaining about that. I think we're about the only talk show program where it's live, and B, we didn't go anywhere. And the reason for that is we can't afford to. Oh, but it's great fun staying here and doing the program. AJ, the Music Factory, is calling from the Catskills in upstate New York. Jesus, how's your weather?
What was that, Mike? I can't hear you. There's too much snow in my ears.
I'll bet. Boy, you guys, you've really taken a beating, haven't you?
Well, no, we have not. It was the eastern portion of the state that bought it, really.
So, oh, okay.
Whatever we have on the ground here is unusually low, actually.
Really?
And yeah. It's very strange. And I would say proportionately, you guys are getting worse weather than we are because we're used to this, but you're not used to what you're getting.
No, we're not.
So, well, Mike, we were coming home from Arizona last week from a bunch of gigs that we had out there.
Right.
And we're pulling into Minneapolis Airport for the connection.
Uh-huh.
And the flight attendant comes on the microphone and says the usual things, welcome to Minneapolis where the local time is, so forth and so on. Please put your trays in an upright position.
Yeah.
Electronic devices off. And then she says, and ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to pay special tribute this evening to one of our passengers who is a uniformed Marine. Please thank him with your applause.
You're kidding.
Nope, and I nearly lost it. I don't know how I managed to get off that plane without saying anything because I was fuming.
Yeah.
And I had a Facebook conversation with a bunch of my friends, and good lefties did not see my point. They were still falling back into this, well, it's important to honor the people who serve this country. And, of course, as I said, they don't serve the country. They work in the military. It's their choice. These are kids who are duped anyway into thinking what they're thinking. But beyond that, are we to now go to the butcher shop or a pound of ground round and have to salute the flag? Do we have to go into a clothing store and when we buy a pair of pants and a tie, have to sing the national anthem? I mean, this is what. Where are we going with this?
Well, I'll tell you, one of the places we're going the other night, I was watching, one of the Sunday night football programs on ESPN. And the four former jock, I don't know who they were, and I don't care, don't want to know, but the former jock commentators who are sitting there, two white guys, two black guys, trying to elevate professional football to some kind of discussion that made sense. But the thing that was infuriating to me was the fact that all four of these guys had American flags in their lapels.
Yeah.
Almost as though it's required now. You cannot go on television if you're a sports commentator without one of these phony-ass little flag lapels. And
right.
it's little stuff like that. I have no problem with showing respect to anybody. You know, I hate religion, but I'm not going to get in a priest's face, even a priest or a minister, a rabbi, or an imam, and say, you phony bastard. I just don't do it. I think the militarization of this society is horrible, but I'm not going to walk up to somebody that's, you know, got desert fatigues on or something and say, hey, you're a jerk. You know, it's just not, I wasn't raised that way. I guess I can fall back on that. But when I turn on television to watch a football game or whatever, and I see these four clowns sitting there with American flags in their lapels, I just think to myself, Jesus Christ, what does your belt buckle say? Does it say, Gott mit uns? You know.
Yeah, right, exactly.
So, hey, listen, we're out of time. AJ.
Better dead than red, Mike.
Yeah, call me again. Take care, pal. Take care. Gosh, time just rips by when you're having fun, doesn't it? I'll see you tomorrow night, all right? Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.